Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 26. Today on the show, I have Steve Fudge, UK Senior Athletics Coach. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right, welcome back to another episode of the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 26. I'm your host, Joel Smith, and coming back at you with some of the best and brightest speed, strength, track coaches, physiologists, nutritionists in the world, and we have a great one for you today with Steve Fudge, who is a athletics coach at the UK working with track and field athletes. Steve has he's really churned out some good athletes, known as an amazing coach, and if you haven't heard of him, especially over here in the Western Hemisphere, he's had two sub-10 sprinters and a variety of other great athletes. Steve is the epitome of a lateral thinker. He's had background and interests in therapy, nutrition, philosophy, neuroscience, and he applies it all well to sport. And I think that listening to the podcast today, you're going to see a lot of that shine through. We're going to talk about a variety of things. A lot of it's going to center on the weight room and speed. I was just at a seminar this past weekend in Chicago where that was a huge topic of interest because you had a lot of conflicting opinions on, you know, where does the weight room exactly transfer for various aspects of speed and how can we optimize that? And there's really nothing better to measure your program against this track and field allows. So Steve has just such a great opinion there, as he was a multidisciplinary strength coach, traveled around the world and got a lot of different experiences in that before he really started training track and field sprinters. So that's just a really interesting area and a great way to derive some context from in your own lifting programs and how that transfers to speed. I always enjoy speaking with coaches who do have a variety of backgrounds, and I think that every individual sport or doing strength and conditioning for a different individual sports, it all adds in our own awareness and the global piece of the puzzle. And we're going to get a lot out of that. And I think you just really see it in Steve's answers that he has, just this experience and, you know, the hormonal adaptations of the athlete, as well as the neural and what you're seeing in the biomechanics. And I'm really excited to have that multidisciplinary effect here on the podcast today. Some of the more specific things we're going to get into is like double versus single leg movements in the weight room, just the role of the weight room in general in building speed, one rep maxes, hormonal adaptations in the weight room. That was just a great piece, and I'm excited for you guys to hear and listen about that, hamstring injury, potentiation, and more. So it's a great episode today. Any coach who's into sort of building speed, power in that realm is going to love this one, and I think there's just great ramifications for all areas. So without further ado, let's get on to the episode 26, Steve Fudge. All right, Steve, welcome to the show today. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Joel. Thanks for asking me.
Absolutely, man. And could you just start, before we really get into the questions, could you just share a little bit of your background in like S&C, track and field, and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, I studied sports science at the University of Edinburgh. I graduated from there and then, you know, decided that I wanted to do some form of coaching, but didn't really know how and where to begin and what sort of stuff I wanted to do. So I kind of, you know, went on a sort of like trip around the world to spend some time in some places. I went to the University of Washington in Seattle to do a strength conditioning internship. I went from there to the Australian Institute of Sport to do a sort of volunteer internship there. And then I ended up in Queensland with some of the professional sports teams there, the Queensland Reds and the Lions, and, you know, just doing some sort of volunteer sort of strength and conditioning stuff. And then I think the UK, we got the London 2012 Olympics, and from that we started to invest a lot into our coaching infrastructure. You know, and then I came back to the UK and sort of got involved with doing a, what was called an apprentice position as a strength and conditioning coach. And that was based in Wales. You know, and I did that for 4 to 5 years. And then, you know, lucky enough, there was sort of a change in sort of British Athletics approach to things, and they had some money to do with us getting the Olympics, and they put on an apprentice coach program, which was track coaching, and I did that for 2 years. You know, lucky enough to sort of be influenced by some of the great people that we had here in the country, and also by some of the great coaches that we do have here in the UK. So, you know, after that, after the London 2012 Olympics, I kind of was out on my own as a track coach, and from that point onwards, I kind of started to build a group here in the UK. Lucky enough to coach some good athletes along the way. First off, started coaching the 400 meter event. And I had one athlete called Richard Buck, who was kind of sort of my first sort of big sort of name, I guess. You know, and he ended up running 45.8 indoors and had a good sort of solid 400 meter performances outdoors. And then I guess my big breakthrough came when I was lucky enough to pick up an athlete called James Dasa-Olu, who was a very talented sprinter here in the UK, and kind of fixed him up a little bit. And he went on to run 9.91. He went on to run 6.47. You know, and he ended up, you know, sort of having a good couple of years, winning European Championships, won the Intercontinental Cup. And then from there, the group kind of just grew out a little bit, and we started to get some more athletes in. I took over Johnny Peacock's coaching from Dan Path for a little time, and, you know, managed to sort of, you know, have some success with Johnny. He won the world champs, the Paralympic world champions in the T44 classification. And then obviously I've taken on an athlete called Adam Dubilly. I coached him for the last 3 years. And he was the first sort of British sprinter to make a sub 10 performance and a sub 20 performance. And then, you know, just recently, over the last 2 years, I've started to branch out to female athletes, which is something I just happened that I never coached any before. And, you know, I've started to do that, and had one athlete this year who kind of won an Olympic medal as part of the relay team. So that's kind of my and what I've done up to this point.
That's awesome, man. I really like how, and what I've heard about the apprenticeship program over there in the UK, just sounds like an amazing way to get kind of fixed up with mentors and people. And well, the first kind of main question I'm going to ask you is, Steve, so how has your experience originally as a strength coach going into track then helped your work later on as a track coach? And maybe a more expansive question, and feel free to answer this to whatever extent you feel, but what do you now view the role of the weight room is in building speed?
Okay. Yeah, I think just for the first part of the question, I think being a strength coach originally has massively helped my coaching as a track coach. You know, I think I look back on it, and being a sort of strength coach just gives you a really strong foundation of both the science and the art of coaching. I think on the science side, you learn about mechanics and movement and, you know, the neurology and the physiology and the biochemistry. And then on the coaching side, you learn how to, you know, coach certain types and different types of athletes. You learn your cues that work with, you know, different types of athletes. You learn how to set up workouts and training service sessions and organization of, you know, people through a weight room and all that sort of really positive stuff that can help you further on. And, you know, I think I look back on my time as a sort of strength coach, and I spent some time with athletes from team sports and athletes from endurance sports and athletes from, you know, sort of combat sports and all that type of stuff, and, you know, got a real good sort of wide ranging experience of different athletes and how they relate to the different sports that they work in. And then just sort of coming on to sort of like the next part of that question, you know, getting to work with all those different athletes in all those different sports, you really learn that the weight room is kind of it's part of a broader jigsaw puzzle. You know, it is a part and it's an important part, but you know, what's really important is how that part of the jigsaw puzzle coming from the strength room, you know works into the rest of the bigger program. You know, there's plenty examples of my times working as a strength coach when I, you know, I thought I was writing the best strength program that you could possibly write, and, you know, but the reality was it doesn't matter how good the strength training program is, that, you know, the overall training program has to be good. You know, so it's the whole package and the whole continuum of what the athlete's been exposed to, you know, that which really makes the big difference in the big package. So yeah, look, the weight room stuff is extremely important, and it can have a massive positive and beneficial effect, but, you know, what's really important is how it is packaged into the rest of the training that the athlete is exposed to, and how that sort of, you know, gels together and works together with the track program. So yeah, I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no doubt. I like how you mentioned it as kind of a jigsaw puzzle. Or with the strength training and the track and speed, I've thought of it almost as a chemistry set or something like that, like the different reactions and where the different things fit into the total program. And I definitely in total agreement too. If that total program isn't good, the weight room isn't necessarily going to be able to help a whole lot.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
What do you think, Steve, in terms of the point where, and I guess this is probably different for everybody, but the point in times ran on the track where you'd say strength probably isn't a factor anymore? Or is there ever a point where you aren't really trying to increase someone's 1RM, or where you just kind of throw that out the window? And then with maybe less qualified athletes, are you trying to really ever push their weightlifting up? And so where does that whole, you know, the story of weightlifting maxes and maximal abilities fit into the equation of speed for you?
Yeah, I think in my experience, it's, you know, the athletes that, you know, I've worked with, you know, their strength, power and elastic qualities, you know, they're already pretty good. You know, most 10-0 guys or sub-10 guys or, you know, 11-0 females will have, you know, really good strength, power and elastic qualities, you know, which I would call, you know, they're in the ballpark. You know, and so largely my experience has been coaching that side and that level of athletes. So then, you know, for me, the strength program then becomes more about maintaining that force generation quality, maintaining the physiology around that. And secondly, sort of making the delivery of the forces, you know, much more efficient, and how the person delivers that force into the track. And then for me, you know, thirdly, I think it, you know, it's about how does that, you know, how does the work we're doing to maintain the strength physiology, how does the work we're doing to improve force generation fit into the overall training program, and how does it sort of sit with managing the overall training process? So, you know, I think with the athletes I work with, that's what I've been more concerned with rather than setting targets and goals. However, you know, we're working with athletes, we work in a very outcome-based sport. You know, the only thing that matters in our game is when they cross the line is what that number flashes up. So our athletes are very used to working with immediate feedback. They're very used to getting targets put out there. And I think, you know, I've never want an athlete to go into the weight room unmotivated. So yeah, of course, we definitely give them ideas of, you know, weights that we want them to hit and targets we want them to hit. And we want them to keep progressing in the weight room, but, you know, we don't necessarily want it to become a weight room exercise in terms of, you know, the whole program becomes about how strong they are. We want them to progress and move forward in the weight room in such a way that it helps them sort of, you know, complements their running program.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I really like, Steve, what you said there at the end. Like, track athletes in particular are used to immediate feedback and measurements, and this isn't necessarily question I had in the formal list, but what are your thoughts on monitoring and measuring stuff in the weight room, like bar speeds or things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to, look, I think we're all aware of, you know, if we want people to run at 12 meters per second, you know, the most specific and the most primary stimulus that we can give them is fast running sessions. You know, that's the thing, that's the driver of that. Now, you know, what we're looking for the weight room to do is provide an environment which is positive and progressive in terms of their physical potentials. It's positive and progressive in terms of how they're producing force in smaller ground contacts. So yeah, we want people to come into the weight room and feel motivated to improve on those indices. But you know, we're not saying that if those indices in the weight room improve, that automatically means they're going to run quick on the track. I don't think it does. But you know, we can use those things as a way of, you know, motivating and building the athletes, you know, I guess their self-esteem in their strength, power and elastic qualities, which then they can take forward into the running workouts and move that part of the program forward. Because undoubtedly, you know, we all know the sort of, you know, the research out there in terms of, you know, running is a very specific sport. Running at high speeds is very specific in terms of, you know, the amount of force that you're asking to put into the track in a very small contact time. You know, so I don't look at the weight room as anything in there that matches that in terms of how specific we can be in that respect. But, you know, we can definitely use things in the weight room to move forward the physical potentials of the athletes, which they can then bring into the runner workouts.
Yeah, that's a great answer. It actually leads me right into the next question, which is, what's your take on some of the more specific weight room exercises in terms of coordination or position or things like that? And maybe not even related to bar speed, but stuff where you're like trying to hit like the hip lock position or some of the things like that Franz Bosch is making popular. And I think Franz Bosch is definitely making a lot of coaches ask really good questions. So what's your take on some of the more specific things that are going on in the weight room?
Yeah, I think, you know, as you know, I very much see the weight room as two particular things. Number one would be, you know, developing the physical potentials of, you know, qualities such as strength and power and rate of force development and elasticity. You know, and then on the second side of it, you know, you've got this sort of how do we develop the athlete's ability to deliver the force that they've got? How do we improve that? And I think there's definitely, in the work that I've done with the athletes I've coached, we've definitely used certain exercises to try and improve that. For example, where Franz Bosch talks about the cross extensor reflex, which, you know, is basically, you know, as one leg is extending, the other leg's flexing. So we've definitely used a couple of exercises which really sort of improve that capacity and try and tap in the athlete's ability to tap into that reflex, because it's a reflex. You know, we've generally, you know, understand the importance of dorsiflexion, you know, in all phases of the, you know, the 100-meter sprint or any type of sprint. So, you know, we've definitely used exercises which kind of, you know, work on that, you know, especially during the front end of the race. We've definitely, you know, seen that dorsiflexion is very, very important to be able to put force into the track, you know, and also the sort of, you know, you know, dorsiflexion at the ankle and then, you know, hip flexion, that sort of relationship. So we've done a couple of things that focused on that. So, you know, those exercises are probably not intensive enough to stimulate the, you know, the big physical adaptations that we're using other exercises for. But I think there's definitely a place that they can use to teach some neat skill sets, which the athletes can then take into their running.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned there just about teaching, and it's about teaching and at least in my opinion too, like what can you teach in the weight room the athlete can take with them in terms of the coordination. You mentioned the cross extensor exercise, and maybe I'm sure it's probably kind of hard to describe on audio, and I mean maybe I can even find a video to put in show notes, but could you try to describe like an example of a cross extensor exercise? Or are you talking about things like maybe a single leg clean where you finish with a leg on a box or other types of movements?
Yeah, we played around with with some of Franz Bosch's stuff, and we've also sort of played around with stuff itself with dumbbells and various type of things. It's hard to describe visually, but you know, basically, we found a lot that flexion, hip flexion, and done properly is quite a hard skill to do. So we found that that's quite a limiting factor in, how the athlete and that reflex can sort of, come together. So, we've done a lot of exercises, which are kind of sort of working on that end range hip flexion, that above 90 degrees hip flexion, and making sure that the pelvis can stay in the correct position for that to materialize. So, that's sort of the sort of focus that we've had for those exercises.
Okay, awesome. And with the above 90 degrees too, so the thigh being above 90, is that to kind of try to stimulate more the iliopsoas or do some other things in the hips? What's some of the rationale behind the above 90?
Yeah, I think it's, we're trying to sort of ensure that the athlete can perform a clean sort of hip flexion without the pelvis rotating, which then, as you sort of suggest, it ties in with the sort of the correct muscles that we want to be operating. I think obviously if the pelvis starts to rotate, then you lose the insertion and origin points of the muscles, and then you lose that ability to produce elastic energy and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, I think there's a real sort of importance on being able to make sure that that there can be a correct sort of hip flexion at the pelvis with the hip, with the pelvis maintaining its position.
That's awesome. So like you're using it to kind of almost teach joint differentiation in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you mentioned teaching earlier. So, one of the things that we have found with focusing on this stuff in the weight room is that you can stand on the side of a track and, you can reference back to the weight room and say, remember that skill set that you learned, and it gives you a sort of neural teaching link back into the weight room, which you can then use on the track side. So that's been an interesting thing for me that I've learned about that whole process.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Oh man, that's awesome. I really like that. And maybe a little bit more down the specificity train as I continue to move on is what's your take on some single or double leg movements in the weight room?
I think your double leg movements are something which you're going to use to drive your physical, your hormonal, your cross-sectional area sort of, demands that you want to move forward. Those are the things that are really going to push your generic physical qualities forward, squats, deadlifts. We've used both in our programs depending on the individuals that we've got. The squat is something which, with James Dasaulu, the guy who's ran sub 10, we found with him 6 to 8 weeks of squatting, can really, give him a massive positive adaptation in terms of cross-sectional area, in terms of, neural sort of firing power, and a psychological benefit, all those different type of things. I think obviously the thing with double leg lifting is to look at the individuals that you've got. You need to look at how they're set up in terms of their levers, how they're set up in terms of, can they take the compression through their lumbar spine? Can their sort of sacrum and ilium, hold together and not have any problems from double leg lifting? A lot of history. What are the athletes comfortable? Are they comfortable and have a background with squatting? Are they comfortable and have a background with deadlift? And it's trying to fix, put the right sort of athlete into the right sort of exercise. And sometimes we've had athletes who it just isn't suitable to do that much double leg lifting with. I think with Adam Jamili, we found that he was a guy who had a very stiff situation around his hip, pelvis, and lumbar spine. We found that if we use too much double leg lifting, we would run into problems, which would then affect his ability to produce his running workouts. So, at that stage, you're not going to you're not going to stop running workouts to allow the person to double leg lift, so you have to look for alternatives. So that kind of leads me on to sort of things like single leg lifts, which, you know, which you can then use as an alternative. You know, obviously takes the weight off the lumbar spine, the loading off the lumbar spine, the compression off the lumbar spine, which is all great, you know, and has less of an impact then across the training week. You know, and I think those single leg exercises can really sort of give you an opportunity to sort of, you know, maintain, progress and push forward, you know, the sort of things that you want to do in terms of, you start to throw in the coordination side of things, you start to throw in the sort of, you know, the sort of the neural aspects, the balance aspects, you know, that side of things, you get that sort of crossover starts to come in when you bring in a sort of single leg activities.
Well, that's a great answer. So it sounds kind of like your the mentality first and foremost is just the health of the athlete, more so than possible an adaptation might be kind of second to that.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, as I said, you know, the number one reason why somebody progresses in the running is by doing more running. So, you know, our strategy, our philosophy has always been to protect high velocity running workouts. Now, if there's anything that comes in the weight room which kind of impacts on that, yeah, we're 100%, you know, we're going to prioritize high velocity running workouts because that's the thing that the athletes need to do. It's the primary driver. It's the primary stimulus. So, you know, it's being really careful about the athletes you've got in terms of looking at how they function, looking at what's possible in terms of the levers, looking at what's possible in terms of, you know, the stiffness that they want or they need, or the stiffness that they don't want and they don't need, and all those type of things, and really just sort of making good sound decisions about how the weight room, you know, fits into the running program and how the weight room kind of complements rather than takes away from the running program.
That's great. You mentioned something a little bit before, James, like you would do 8 weeks of solid lifting with him that put him in a good place. And what's the most you would do in terms of like building the battery? Is how long do you think you can do some of that more intensive stuff in the weight room before it starts to become a problem?
Yeah, I think my experience is generally with the guys. I was able to maybe push that sort of stuff for like a six to eight week period. And then as faster running sort of came in, maybe sort of 3 to 4 weeks before the start of the season, you know, we'd then have a problem of being able to keep that big, as you call it, increasing the battery type exercises in the program. And we then have to drift them out and replace them with, you know, what one thing we would like to do was, you know, we take the, for example, with James, we'd squat for 6 to 8 weeks and then we'd take, you know, squatting out. And obviously, you know, as you bring fast running in, fast running becomes the main stimulus and primary stimulus for the athlete. And that actually maintains a lot of the sort of physical, you know, things that you want to maintain because running fast is the most anabolic, the most, you know, hormonally specific, the most neurally specific adaptations that you could possibly want. But then, you know, we did other sort of neater sort of psychological things where we replaced the squat with the bench, for example. So you're still getting that neurological sort of impact in the gym and the athlete, you know, still feels comfortable that they're going in there and pressing a lot of weight, but obviously you're taking a lot of the load off the lumbar spine and the sort of, you know, the hip and pelvis area, which really helps. With the female athletes I've coached, you know, I've actually wanted to and tried to keep the big lifts in for as long as I possibly could across not just the training blocks, but in deep into seasons as well. And I found that's really been beneficial, and it's something which I think is really, really important. So that's, you know, there's definitely a different approach there for the sort of the males versus the females, I guess.
Interesting. Yeah, that's not the first time I'd heard that mentioned about keeping strength in a program for females a little bit longer than males. Do you think that that might be just a generality too for more someone with more versus a little bit less muscle mass?
Yeah, look, I think, I mean, you have to realize that, you know, for example, in the 100 meters, their event is happening you know, the female event is happening, you know, seconds slower than the male event. So, you know, the forces that those guys are, you know, producing are less. It's less of a, it's less of a, an, you know, an event which is going to be more suited to the sort of the force producers, the guys that can produce a lot of elasticity, all that sort of stuff. And I think it's more, you know, things like cross-sectional area, things like power to weight ratio, things like fitness become a lot more important in the 100 meters for the females than it does for the males. So, you know, I think, you know, physical preparation, physical conditioning, you know, is more important and needs to be maintained deeper into race seasons. Because, you know, the other thing is, because they're running slower, you have more of an opportunity, you know, they're not recovering from this big, you know, effort as much as the guys are. So you have an opportunity to find those gaps in between races where you can maintain that stuff as well. So I think there's a lot more opportunity for it. And I agree with you. I think it's, you know, the top girls in the world, when you look at their races, I think, you know, a lot more of the sort of reason that the top girls are successful is to do with power to weight ratio, cross-sectional area, those sort of physical qualities.
That's awesome. Fantastic answer there and insight. I really enjoyed that a little bit.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Bouncing back to it kind of gave me another idea in terms of, you know, you're talking about how the strength, what happens to strength when you take it into the season. Do you make any changes between double and single leg work, generally speaking, when you're moving into the competitive season?
Yeah, sorry. I mean, I think I was trying to suggest before that, you know, we do have a progression from a double leg sort of emphasis into a single leg emphasis where possible. But, you know, I generally have kept some double leg Olympics in the program during the season, so a double leg clean. You know, we have from time to time moved that to single leg version. And then, you know, obviously a lot of our, you know, we do bring in a lot of single leg activities as well in terms of maintaining sort of, you know, a stimulus and adaptation through the sort of hip, the posterior chain, that type of thing. So we do sort of make a switch from the sort of training block, which is more double leg emphasis, into the competition blocks where we try and maintain the sort of things that we've improved via the sort of single leg lifts.
Cool. And along those lines too, I've heard you talk about keeping various strength and weight room pieces in the program throughout the season for the response or for the role of like hormonal response to training. Is there a lot of things you're measuring in that capacity? Are you doing blood work with your athletes? And are there things you've learned more on the hormonal level?
Yeah, I mean, we've used a couple of things to try and get to grips with what's happening. You know, we looked into saliva testing. So the athletes would come in, they would, you know, produce a saliva sample. We'd then send that away, and that would, you know, give us an indication of what was going on. But, you know, the problem with that was we were kind of using it to try and make sort of training decisions, but it takes a little while for the saliva samples to, you know, get looked at, and the information comes back maybe, you know, a week or 2 weeks later. So, but, you know, generally with that work, we kind of learned a couple of things. You know, one thing that was quite interesting was with the females, you know, there was, you know, a situation during their menstrual cycle where there would be an opportunity where testosterone was elevated for, you know, a 10-day period, and we found that, you know, we could make a lot of progress in both the running training and the lifting training. We obviously, you know, surprise surprise, we obviously found that, you know, athletes are good at terms of, you know, displaying a stress response, you know, because the reality is we're working with fight or flight animals, you know, flight animals in our game, and we actually want these guys to have a huge stress response. And then, you know, that started to get us thinking that the actual thing that we really wanted to look at wasn't where, you know, the stress hormone response, because we're actually asking them for to do that. What we started to really get concerned about and what was a problem was, you know, can they switch on the relaxation response? Can they upregulate their parasympathetic nervous system response? And so we kind of moved away from the saliva samples, and then we looked into using we used a system called the first beat system, which basically was a heart rate variability system. And what we were using that for was to try and see if we could get a read on and an awareness of, you know, how quickly could the athletes move from that stress response, fight or flight, which we want them to have. We want them to be able to produce that. But, you know, how fast can they switch that off and switch on their parasympathetic nervous system, you know, and basically upregulate that. And we found that that's where one of our main problems was. We found that some athletes were, you know, unable to do that very, very quickly after workouts. You know, they would basically have a stress response elevated during the night. They find it very difficult to, you know, during the sleep, to basically sort of move into the deeper sleep, the restoration sleep that they needed. You know, and, you know, I think you know, with some athletes, we found that, for example, you know, they weren't getting into deep relaxation sleep until, you know, 2-3 hours after they went to bed and all that sort of stuff. So we started to work really hard on things like that, and trying to improve that situation. So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but, you know, that's our experience that we've had over the last 3 or 4 years. And we've spent definitely more time sort of, yeah, looking into the sort of, we're accepting the situation that we're in an event that requires a stress response, but, you know, having accepted that, then looking how do we switch that off and upregulate these guys in terms of the recovery mechanisms.
Yeah, I think that's an awesome answer. And yeah, just like putting that time and energy into monitoring how to promote recovery is, I think that's really important. And I think that's really interesting. One other question that is maybe not so much related, slightly different direction. But what's your take on reducing the incidence of hamstring injuries in athletes? Obviously, a lot of multifactorial things, but if you had maybe two or three like real big factors or things you look at, what are those?
Yeah, I think my take on this one is pretty simple. I think you know, athletes will hurt their hamstrings because of poor programming. More than anything else. You know, for me, it's the management of the training process to ensure that, you know, the high velocity running sessions are protected, that the athlete is never sort of entering into a high velocity running session in a fatigue state. You know, that's my biggest thing. So, you know, I very much would sort of look at that as being the biggest thing that you can take care of as a coach. Just organize your training around your high velocity running sessions. You know, you build in those sessions into your training week, so your blocks or whatever, and then you absolutely ensure that there's enough recovery between those big stresses, those big sessions. And then, you know, the neat thing that you can do with that is, you know, if there is some hamstring conditioning work you want to do, you know, I found the best place to do that hamstring conditioning work is immediately post the big running stimulus. So then that gives you and maximizes the amount of time that you've got until your next big running stimulus. So, you know, my take on it is, as a coach, the biggest thing you can do is just organize your training program around your high velocity, high stressful, you know, days, and you know, build in plenty of time for recovery after that. You know, and then, you know, my second take on it is that your programming is the big thing you got to get right, but you can build yourself a safety cushion or an insurance policy, you know, by, you know, making mechanics as good as they possibly can be. And obviously, you know, making sure your physical sort of preparation and conditioning of the posterior chain, or, you know, or the body is as good as it possibly can do. But, you know, that for me is just, that's secondary, that's background. That gives you a little bit of a safety cushion. But, you know, for me, you can have the best mechanics in the world, or you can have the most physically prepared hamstrings in the world. But, you know, if your training program isn't allowing you enough recovery and you're coming to training sessions fatigued, then it doesn't matter how good that other stuff is. So, yeah, I guess that's my take on it.
That's awesome. I think that I especially like what you said about the spacing of the workouts, because I've seen similar things. Like as a strength coach for track, In the past, I could do all these things, but if usually it was particular workout sequences where I saw athletes who would pull a hammy. So I think that's a great insight. The last question I got for you here, Steve, on this show today is maybe looping back around a little bit. I had it as my last question, but probably could have been in there a little bit earlier. What's your idea on the role of potentiation from the weight room to the track? So are you ever doing any like types of complex work? Are you ever using the weights, like the bigger magnitude stuff like bench or squat or even bench to try to enhance the track from a neural level in the short term?
Yeah, I think in terms of potentiation, we kind of looked at two things. The second one that we sort of looked at, not the one that you described there, but the thing that we actually used and got quite a lot of gain from was sort of hormonal potentiation in terms of, you know, tapping into the, you know, looking at the type of athletes that you've got and, you know, and their circadian rhythms. And we found that generally we had a couple of guys who were early risers. And then we also had a couple of guys who were kind of sort of late risers and in terms of the circadian rhythms. And, you know, we found that, you know, we could do things like, you know, do a gym session in the morning, which would then help for a running session in the afternoon. You know, we also found that if the guys come in and did a little workout in the morning, you know, then they could sort of, you know, increase, you know, we did things like measure the body temperature, and we found that they were coming into the afternoon session with a higher body temperature, which, you know, obviously helps for speed and power production. And so, you know, that's one thing we did look at. And had some success with, but again, it was tapping into the individuals, you know, and their particular sort of circadian rhythm. And, you know, that was kind of something that we kind of built up a profile of using the sort of monitoring systems that we did have in place. In terms of the neural potentiation, you know, going back to the sort of first thing you mentioned, to be really honest, I don't think as a coach I've ever been brave enough to sort of, you know, use, you know, a big lift and then ask the athletes to run fast. So I've never had any experience with it. It's not something that I've kind of used, but I'd be interested. And I think there's probably a particularly really sort of good opportunity to do that with female athletes. And I think that would kind of help. So yeah, I think we've definitely looked at the hormonal potentiation way more than the neural potentiation stuff.
Yeah, I know, like, yeah, with the research on the brain and the neural response to training, I mean, it's such a young field and there's so many still to learn and a lot of risk reward along the way too, that might require more experimentation that is worth it sometimes. I did actually have a question there on that hormonal and the circadian rhythm. So is it more like the morning athletes that you would have them do that morning stuff and then like the gym sessions, and then the night people would get to sleep in a little bit, or what was the exact take with that?
Yeah, I think, Adam Jamili, he was a guy who, you know, we found that he was going to sleep really late and he was waking really late. And if we were to do a workout for him in the morning, it would be, you know, quite sort of a situation which wasn't quite sort of, you know, hormonally great for him. So, you know, we did look at staging and putting his workouts later in the day. And then obviously, you know, other example would be the exact opposite. So James was a guy who went to bed early and got up early. So, you know, it was a real profitable time in the morning for him to train. So, you know, with with Adam, we did look into and used, you know, a little warm up, you know, not early in the morning, but you know, late morning to allow a setting up for a sort of late afternoon, early evening type workout, which we thought really helped him. So that's the kind of things that we played around with, and it was just you know, realizing that you're working with full time athletes, and we have an opportunity to train later in the day, and you know, if that suits them as, you know, hormonally, then why wouldn't we shift our day around to take advantage of that? So, you know, that's something that we thought was important and something that we tried.
That's awesome. I really like that. Yeah, just it's simple stuff, but stuff a lot of people don't really think about. I mean, just those differences in athletes and sleep and wake. And I've worked with swimmers and track athletes too, totally different. And I'm sure even within the sport, you got those different people, and it just makes so much sense to make those adjustments.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, that's the end of the time for the show today, but I really appreciate you staying up late, your time there in the UK to do this, and it means a lot to me, and I really think our listeners out there are going to love this show. So thank you so much, Steve.
No worries. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
All right, that wraps it up for today. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you guys next week with a new episode. And in the meantime, please check out our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end, fine training technology, such as the K-Box, FreeLap System, GymAware, and more. Check them out. We'll see you guys next week. Have a good one.